the people responsible for the breakdown didn't understand how to run the system. And indeed, when it comes to the Middle East, those that came after Kissinger, in terms of the presidents and secretaries of state in the United States, knew not Kissinger, knew not how to respect the constraints of the order, the necessary constraints of the order that he had built. And therefore, the United States played an instrumental role in destroying the order that was an American-dominated order. And the most obvious example, of course, is Bush 43's invasion of Iraq, which did more to destabilize the order than anything.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. For 20th century politicians and diplomats, one of the most vexing international issues has been the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or the Israeli-Arab conflict. And there are a lot of explanations for why it seems like this problem is intractable. I've studied the Ottoman Empire, and some would say that because of the dissolution of the empire and how national borders were redrawn for Middle Eastern nations in the 20th century, that don't pay any attention to the history of the ethnic populations or religious populations that live there, the entire region is prone to be chaotic. Others say that the United States' support of Israel, regardless of what it does, has led to instability. Others would blame the Palestinian leadership, that it's led by Hamas, a group that calls for the destruction of Israel. And others think it's essentially an unsolvable problem. Well, more than 20 years have passed since the United States last brokered a peace agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. In that time, three presidents have tried and failed. Today's guest is Martin Indyke. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Israel and special envoy for the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in 2013, and he's experienced these political frustrations firsthand. Well, he's also the author of a new book on Henry Kissinger, and he wrote this book in order to understand the arc of American diplomatic influence in the Middle East. That's because Kissinger is the man who created the Middle East peace process. The name of the book is Master of the Game, Henry Kissinger and the Art of Middle East Diplomacy. Based on newly available documents from American and Israeli archives, extensive interviews with Kissinger, and Indyke's own interactions with some of the main players, we discuss how American diplomacy operates behind closed doors. Indyke argues that understanding Kissinger's designs for Middle Eastern peacemaking is key to comprehending how and how not to make peace. And in this episode, we also get into much larger questions of how peace between nations and how diplomacy actually works, whether it works to promote peace or if you have to first support order, even if it's order created by an iron-fisted dictator, and you need that before you can have peace. A view that sometimes Kissinger promoted, and he took the model of Otto von Bismarck in the 19th century, and whether that's an unfortunate but necessary approach to take, or it's something that promotes dictatorship and actually stands in the way of peace. So these get into huge questions of how peace can be achieved, why we haven't seen that succeed in the Middle East after all these decades, and what lessons we can take from one of the most important players in international diplomacy, Henry Kissinger, on what to do and what not to do. A lot of big questions here, but I think there's really a lot to take out of this discussion. So I hope you enjoyed this interview with Martin Indyke. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Scott.
Well, the issue we're going to talk about is war and peace in the Middle East, an enormous topic, but the person who will guide us through is the topic of your biography, Henry Kissinger, and what he can tell us and teach us, both for good and for ill, how to approach this. To enter into this topic area from the 30,000-foot view, the issue of peace in the Middle East, specifically between the Israelis and the Palestinians, but more expansively with the entire region, what's interesting is that so many people have approached this issue from completely mutually contradictory perspectives. So a few of the different views on what could be done to broker peace between Israelis and Palestinians, some international studies professors might argue that warfare is baked into the Middle East due to the national boundaries that were drawn up after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire that pay no attention to ethnic or religious or sectarian history. A academic from the post-colonial perspective might blame capitalism itself or the CIA or the oil lobby, excuse me, for stifling out human rights and for Western governments that make deals with dictators. In the early 2000s, neoconservatives would say that we have to incubate democracy in the Middle East, and if we do so, it'll flourish in the way that Japan and Germany's democracy did after World War II. In the early 2000s, Thomas Friedman said that he had secret conversations with cab drivers and diplomats at Davos meetings who whispered secret plans for worldwide peace, but we just have to listen to Thomas Friedman, he'll tell it to us. Or a hawkish critic might say today that Washington's foreign policy establishment has failed for decades because of groupthink and these Georgetown graduates who all read the same books on foreign policy and spend time at embassy parties drinking wine and speaking to educated English-speaking nationals. They'll claim they have all the answers, but they're ignorant to the real politic of what actually needs to be done to promote peace in the Middle East. So there's all these mutually contradictory perspectives. But for you as a career diplomat who has spent his career considering these questions and working as hard as you possibly can to arrive at answers, to tackle a very complicated question with a very complicated issue with a simple question, what have we missed?
Well, my career was first as an academic and then as a think tank policy analyst and researcher. And then I went into the government as a political appointee, not as a foreign service officer, for Bill Clinton, and worked on his peace team in the 1990s. That was the era of Rabin and Peres, Arafat, and the Oslo Accords, and also the Israel-Jordan peace treaty, which we negotiated as well. But it ended in a paroxysm of violence with the Intifada, second Intifada that broke out in 2000 and consumed the whole edifice of peace that we had painstakingly constructed over the previous 8 years. And I came back and tried again under John Kerry when he was Secretary of State and was his envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. And by the end of 9 months of final status negotiations, we ended up in a situation in which the parties were further apart than they were at the beginning. And so I left government service feeling that I really didn't have the answer as to what was the right way to try to resolve the Arab-Israeli and Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And therefore, I needed to go back to where it all began and try to understand its origins. And the work of one Henry Kissinger, who, when he was Secretary of State, spent 4 years negotiating Arab-Israeli peace and laying the foundations for the American-led peace process that we've known of ever since. So we're going back to 1973, when Henry Kissinger first engaged in that effort. And I was there when the 1973 October War, Yom Kippur War, as it's called, broke out. I was in Jerusalem as a student. And it was a life-forming experience for me. And so I felt like I would go back and see where it all began and see what we could glean from the viewpoint of the end of the peace process as we have known it, because I presided over the last final status negotiations. That was in 2014. There hasn't been another final status negotiation between Israelis and Palestinians since then. And I don't expect there will be anytime soon. So the idea was to go back to its origins, looking at it from the point of view, looking at the beginning of the process from the point of view of the end of the process, and try to understand what happened, what Kissinger was able to do and why, where he failed and made mistakes and why, and see whether that could help as a guidepost to future diplomats as they try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, let's begin with Mr. Kissinger himself. Can you tell me about his background and salient points of his life leading up to his career?
Yeah, well, I think and my study is of the 4 years that he was Secretary of State and the lead up to that when he was National Security Advisor, but it's not a biography of Henry Kissinger. It's just Henry Kissinger's diplomacy in the Middle East. His background, though, is important. I think you're right to ask the question because he, of course, was Jewish. A German Jewish refugee who came to the United States running away from Nazism. And 13 of his close family relatives died in concentration camps or in Nazi suppression. And so his formative experiences as a teenager were of chaos, a deeply threatening chaos. And I think that has informed his approach to international relations ever since. And if you look at his body of work, of which there is a great deal, he's written, I don't know how many books now, maybe 25. He's got two more books coming out now at the age of 98. But his focus has always been in his writings, his studies as a historian, and his work as America's leading diplomat. His focus has been on order. And it's order that he considers the most important value in international affairs, and how to build it and how to maintain an order is for him far more important than actually achieving peace. It's not that order that he would pursue order without peace. It's that order has to come first before peace. And that was the kind of revelation to me in my study of his diplomacy in the Middle East, because I thought that he was the peacemaker. But in fact, what he was doing was creating an American-led, American-dominated order in the Middle East. And that order that he created lasted pretty much for 50 years until it started to come apart now.
I'd like to explore that idea of order and to explicate Henry Kissinger's idea. That could mean a lot of different things. One could argue that North Korea has order in the sense that there is an uncontested power. That's one extreme versus the other extreme in that, like, maybe there's an order that everyone has fealty to, but they're on the ground, it's complete chaos. Right. What would be the order that Henry Kissinger would say, let's establish this first, and I'm willing to accept this amount of anti-democratic measure to maintain this order? Now, he wouldn't accept Nazi idea of order because he lived it and say that's too far, but I'll accept, let's say, Saddam Hussein. So torture chambers, yes, but better than sectarian chaos. I don't know. So where would be his line of acceptable order to achieve his ends?
Well, I think the order that he's talking about is an order in international affairs between states. He is, in many ways, a kind of Westphalian man, a sense of great devotee of international order. And that's where his focus is. Now, so when you come to what happens within states, his predisposition is to say what happens within states is the affairs of those states, and to basically accept the principle of non-interference in the affairs of other states. Now, as you say, Nazism is something that he certainly fought against, fought in the Second World War as a volunteer. But his focus in his work and in his diplomacy was on order between states, and the order that he was seeking to protect was an order that prevented efforts by states to intervene in the affairs, overthrow the governments of other states, occupy them, whatever. His idea was that you needed a balance of power and an equilibrium in the balance of power to prevent those kinds of things from happening, to deter them from happening. But in the case of Saddam Hussein, for example, he supported George H.W. Bush, or Bush 41, in the idea that Saddam Hussein had to be thrown out of Kuwait. That was unacceptable, to invade another country. But he was not in favor. He supported Bush 41's approach, which was not to go to Baghdad and overthrow Saddam. So I think that that's where he draws the line. Of course, people will say, well, what about Chile, where he was involved in the overthrow of a democratically elected government? But that fit into his concept of spheres of influence, where that was in the American sphere of influence, and great powers could have more say about what happened internally in areas that were within their sphere of influence. But it was all, for better or worse, based on the state system and the way to operate the state system so as to preserve stability and order, because that was the best way that you could, in fact, build towards peace.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. This raises a lot of very interesting implications, and I think it returns to arguments of foreign policy that we've seen repeated over and over again. That is, a Otto von Bismarck stability, is that inherently good? Or if it falls apart when the right person isn't there to maintain it, as we see with Kaiser Wilhelm in World War I, then some would say, well, if the system was corrupt from the start and the edifice was always rotten, it simply was going to collapse at a certain time, versus those who would say, there was nothing wrong with the system inherently, but those who weren't there to maintain order and were too naive to do so, due to their naivete, explains why it collapsed, which is a whole separate discussion, which I suppose we can come into when we see the... Yes.
Kissinger, that's exactly Kissinger's approach to the Middle East, was based on his understanding of the European order that existed before World War I. The first book he published, which was his doctoral dissertation, was written about that period. It was called The World Restored, Castlereagh, Metternich, and the Problems of Peace. And what he did when it came to the Middle East was to try to take that order and use it as a template for the order that he built in the Middle East. And it worked pretty well, even though it was a European system. And indeed, his critique was exactly what you said, Scott. His critique of what happened with the breakdown of order after 100 years of relative stability and relative peace in Europe was that the people responsible for the breakdown didn't understand how to run the system, that Bismarck was the last one to understand how to run the system that Metternich and Castlereagh built. And indeed, when it comes to the Middle East, those that came after Kissinger, in terms of the presidents and secretaries of state in the United States, knew not Kissinger, knew not how to respect the constraints of the order, the necessary constraints of the order that he had built. And therefore, the United States played an instrumental role in destroying the order that was an American-dominated order. And the most obvious example, of course, is Bush 43's invasion of Iraq, which did more to destabilize the order than anything, than any other revisionist leader in the region did. But it started earlier, with the attempt to achieve a comprehensive solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem in the time that I was working with Bill Clinton, and that led not to peace, but to the Intifada and the destruction of everything we'd built. And Kissinger had a very clear-eyed view of that. His view was that the problem of leaders was that they were too attracted to the kind of siren song of peacemaking, the siren song of what he called immortality. But that was natural, needed to be resisted, because that would lead not to peace, but to its opposite. And he actually says it on the first page of his first book, The World Restored. talks about the paradox that those who pursue peace without respect for order end up destabilizing the order and therefore achieving the opposite of peace. And for me, that was kind of a revelation that occurred as I studied the way that he pursued his policy, because Kissinger's, never very clear about what he's actually up to. But it became clear, and we can talk about this if you like, in the negotiations, the way that he conducted the negotiations. Saddam was ready for peace. Kissinger kind of was holding it, wanted smaller steps, smaller agreements, because he thought that, and he told me this that in my last interview with him, I had about 12 interviews with him. I asked him, why didn't he go for the peace that Jimmy Carter negotiated between Saddam and Begin 2 years after Kissinger left office? But it was very clear that Saddam was ready, even in Kissinger's time. But Kissinger didn't believe it. And I asked him whether he regretted it, and he said no. He said, because I feared that if I pushed it too hard, I would have broken it. And that was like a light bulb going off in my head, because that's what we did in Camp David 2 and the effort to reach a final Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. Instead of achieving an agreement, we broke the process and it exploded. And presidents that came after Bill Clinton haven't been able to put it back together again. Four presidents tried. Bush 43 didn't really try, but certainly Obama and Trump tried to achieve an Israeli-Palestinian peace in their own ways. Trump's vanity project is a whole other thing, but he had people working on it and trying to do it. And none of them been able to achieve it. And that's precisely the point that Kissinger was making on the first page of his first book about the European order and the paradox of peace, or what it was in the title, The Problems of Peace. So that's why he had a preference for order over peace. But it wasn't order without peace. It was order that would lead eventually to peace. But you had to do it cautiously, step by step, incrementally, gradually. Those were his principles for peacemaking.
These are the type of historical figures I'm interested in that you might not necessarily have to agree with them. And as you and many well know, Kissinger has his detractors, some calling him a war criminal. But he wasn't someone who picked the low-hanging fruit or was simply going to go for the easiest win that could have presented itself, but playing a long game. One could argue that the long game was flawed or correct. Without getting too far ahead, I'd like to explore the particulars of what Kissinger did as a Secretary of State and as attempting to negotiate these different peace deals. Let's first explore what you spend time on in your book and his involvement in the Yom Kippur War of 1973. A point you make is that he may have averted it, but chose not to. So can you tell me about this chapter of his life?
Yes. So, of course, you as a historian are very familiar with the counterfactual and what might have happened if only. And so I do look at this period leading up to the war in that context, because Henry Kissinger at that point was National Security Advisor in the first Nixon term. And in the lead up to the war, Anwar Sadat was the president of Egypt, and he constantly warned that if his needs for a return of territory that had been occupied in the 1967 war by Israel, if his needs for a return of Egyptian territory were not met, he would go to war. And he was quite explicit about this, warning for about 2 years that this was going to happen. And Kissinger and the Israelis, and for a large part of it, Sadat's Soviet patrons, didn't take him seriously. Didn't believe him. And the reason they didn't believe him was because Kissingerian balance of power was tilted purposely by the United States in Israel's favor. And the belief was that Israel, the balance tipped in Israel's favor, would deter Egypt and the other Arabs from going to war because they'd get beaten. They were thoroughly whopped in 67, and it would just be a repeat of that. And so the order that Kissinger was maintaining before the 73 war was one in which the within the Middle East heartland, a balance of power tipped in Israel's favor was the way that the order was maintained. And the Soviet Union went along with that until they didn't, until they started to supply Sadat with weapons. That's a whole other story. Kissinger did not appreciate at that point, and he learned it the hard way through the war, that a balance of power alone is insufficient to maintain the order unless that order is legitimate, by which he meant unless it's accepted by the major powers who were involved in the balance. And Egypt did not accept it, but he didn't take Sadat seriously. He referred to him as, he thought he was some character in an opera, Aida, the Egyptian opera. And so when Sadat sent his national security advisor to meet with Kissinger in February of 1973, a secret meeting that took place outside of New York in Armonk, New York, because Kissinger didn't want the State Department to know that he was having this meeting. And Sadat's national security advisor, Hafez Ismail, brought a peace initiative, a quite credible peace initiative, one that Kissinger found interesting. But, you know, Kissinger, I mean, this is the interesting thing about Kissinger, knew all about European order. He knew nothing about the Middle East. And since he was a historian of the Ottoman Empire, he'd never written about the Ottoman Empire, believe it or not. And so the Middle East was just a black box to him. And he didn't know how to evaluate the things that Hafez Ismail was telling him. That Sadat was in a hurry. That Sadat was ready to go ahead of the other Arab states. He wouldn't wait for them. That Sadat wasn't interested in working with the Soviet Union. But it kind of sounded interesting to him. And he then came back to Washington with this peace initiative from Sadat. And he sat down with Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin in those days was the U.S. ambassador, the Israeli ambassador to Washington. And Rabin looked at this and he dismissed it. And Rabin could be very dismissive. He said, you know, we've heard it all before. There's nothing new here. Kissinger is very defensive. He says, well, and then Golda Meir, prime minister, who was really hard bitten, came to town and she dismissed it. So Kissinger backed off, dropped it. And that was in February. In October, Sadat went to war. If Kissinger had taken that initiative seriously, could he have headed off the war is the big counterfactual here. We don't know, it's conjecture. But the consequence of that resistance to change and belief in the order being maintained was that when Sadat actually did go to war, Kissinger knew exactly what he needed to do and intervened quickly to bring the war to an end. It was after 16 days. He actually tried before that, within the second day he tried, but failed. But after 16 days, he intervened with the Soviet Union and negotiated a ceasefire. And his basic purpose was to end the war in a way that would make it possible to jumpstart peace negotiations and to preserve Egypt's ability, Sadat's ability, to go into the negotiations. And so that required him to hold up the Israelis at the end to prevent them from destroying the Egyptian Third Army they had surrounded in order to preserve the Egyptians' ability to negotiate peace. And that's how he started the whole peace process that then he developed over the next 4 years.
Another point you make is that there's an idea that Kissinger withheld arms from Israel at a certain point during the Yom Kippur War as part of this engineering of peace. So could you talk about this belief and whether or not it's true?
Yeah, well, it's not true. Commonly held, particularly amongst Israelis and pro-Israelis in the United States, that's what Kissinger did. But in fact, and I've looked at the historical record very closely, documentation on this, and the documentation is available both in the American archives and in the Israeli archives. What Kissinger did was to use Israel's military offensives to achieve a ceasefire. He needed Israeli military pressure on the Egyptians and the Syrians in order to get them to accept a ceasefire and get the Soviets to back it. The Soviets were supplying the arms to the Egyptians and the Syrians. And so, you know, you can't expect the Israelis would serve his purpose by putting military pressure on them if he was holding up arms to the Israelis. Contradicted his whole approach. Now, he did want to provide them with arms in a low-profile way, and he was not in favor of a major airlift originally. That was in part because he did not, and the Israelis did not tell him for 3 days how badly they were doing at the beginning of that war. But it was also because he was concerned that if the American military resupply was too high profile, the Arabs would respond by imposing an oil embargo. But as it became clear that the Israelis were not doing as well as he needed them to in order to achieve a ceasefire, he changed his view on that. And Nixon ordered this major military airlift, which he certainly went along with and rode herd on the bureaucracy to achieve it. And of course, as he had predicted, that produced an Arab oil embargo. And the Arab oil embargo had a devastating effect, not just on the U.S. economy, but the global economy. Then put it into recession. So it wasn't an unreasonable concern for an American Secretary of State wanting to keep the supplies in a low-profile way. But in the end, that wasn't fit in the circumstances. The Soviets were resupplying. The Israeli counteroffensive wasn't moving. And so that's when Nixon ordered the major airlift.
And listeners, this is an example of the incredible ripple effects and butterfly effects of history, that standoff or an armistice between two nations can cause ripple effects of the global economy, leading to things like 1970s automobiles and the AMC Gremlin and horribly designed fuel-efficient vehicles, and Washington, D.C. architecture, which I imagine in my mind is a gigantic slab of ugly concrete for energy efficiency. So hence the butterfly effect at work, showing the importance of, again, diplomacy at this time period in history. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. And this leads up to Kissinger working with Israeli leadership. And tell me about him trying to persuade them to trade territory for time instead of a territory for peace. And this is at a time where Israel's land holdings, for those who don't know this period, I mean, they control the Sinai Peninsula. It's Israel has three times the land holdings of its current holdings at this time. So can you talk about this process?
Yeah, Israel occupied the Sinai Peninsula, West Bank, and the Golan Heights as a result of the 67 war back in June 1967, Six-Day War. And as I said before, there was approximate cause of the 1973 war was that the Egyptians and Syrians launched this coordinated surprise attack with the purpose of trying to regain the territory. But Sadat's approach was to cross the Suez Canal and hold there and jumpstart a negotiation process in which Israeli territorial withdrawals would take place as a result of negotiations rather than as a result of use of force. So his war had limited political diplomatic aims. Things didn't quite work out that way, but in the end, that's where, once Kissinger had negotiated the ceasefire, it ended up. Kissinger had manipulated things in a way that enabled the Egyptians and Israelis to begin a negotiation, which he served as the mediator for. in order for his American-led peace process diplomacy to work, he had to persuade Israel to give up territory. And they had just come through a war in which they'd lost a lot of soldiers. It was a very traumatic experience for them. They'd thought that they were the superpower of the Middle East, and suddenly they were faced with isolation, embargoes, and even though they turned the tide of battle, nevertheless, they were in a very kind of vulnerable state. So in one sense, he had their attention, especially because the United States was providing massive military airlift of materiel to make up for their losses during the war. But on the other hand, the Israelis were very reluctant to give up territory after this war. And if he couldn't persuade them to give up territory, then he couldn't lubricate his diplomacy, and the United States would not be able to effectively create the new order that he had in mind. It all depended on him convincing the Israelis to give up territory. Now, as we've already discussed, Scott, he was skeptical about peace as an endpoint and wary about the idea. The Israelis were looking for an end to the conflict if they were going to give up territory. They wanted to trade the territory. If they were going to give up any territory, it was going to be for peace. Paradox, Kissinger didn't think that was a great idea. So instead, he had to try to convince them not to give up territory for peace, but to give up territory for time to end their isolation, time to rebuild their military, time to exhaust their Arab opponents so that they would eventually come to accept Israel's existence. And so that was what he was trying to sell them, and he succeeded. In the end, he succeeded. It was a knockdown, drag-out fight. I describe his engagements with Golda Meir. They're quite extraordinary, and the arguments that the two of them had, with Golda playing the victim and seeing the whole world against Israel and therefore arguing that he couldn't afford to take any risks for peace, and Kissinger explaining that if she didn't take some risks, then it was going to be far worse for Israel. And it's an amazing exchange. It goes on for several nights until she finally concedes, all right, she'll try it. And that produced two agreements with Egypt that led to Israel withdrawing in stages from parts of Sinai, peninsula, and one agreement with Syria that involved Israel withdrawing on the Golan Heights. And those were the disengagement and interim agreements that laid the basis for the foundations for the American-led peace process. But I point out at the end of the book that Kissinger actually had been so successful in persuading the Israelis to trade territory for time that it became the basis of their whole approach to the peace process. And they essentially, if you look at the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, they traded all of the Sinai back to the international border with Egypt for being able to hold on to the West Bank. And then they gave up Gaza in order to be able to hold on to the West Bank. And they used time, exactly as Kissinger had recommended to them, to build Israel's strength so that it's by far the strongest military power in the region, perhaps the fourth or fifth strongest in the world, with an array of relations with the Chinese, the Russians, and, you know, you name it. Of course, a strong alliance with the United States, a strong high-tech-based economy. And of course, the ultimate irony is they have gotten to the point where they don't see the need to give up any territory. So territory for time ended up producing an Israeli approach that led it to give less and less territory over time, to the point where now it seems almost inconceivable that they would withdraw from the West Bank. That was not Kissinger's intention.
Right. I was one thing that surprised me last year with the Abraham Accords, which if listeners don't know, this was a peace process between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain, is that Palestine was not a part of it. And whatever you think of the Accords, that completely goes against the whole international relations conventional wisdom. When I was reading this in the early 2000s with Clyde Prestowitz and Thomas Friedman and other people, we're all trying to work out a formula of Israeli-Palestinian peace. It really changes, I mean, the terms of how people are approaching it. So I was surprised to see that.
Yes, but the Abraham Accords were the ultimate vindication of Kissinger's approach in the following sense, that when the Emiratis, Emirates were the ones who led this break from the Palestinians. Previously, the Arabs were waiting to normalize their relations with Israel until there was an Israeli-Palestinian peace and the establishment of a Palestinian state. And what the Emiratis did with the Bahrainis and eventually the Moroccans and the Sudanese was to say, we're not going to wait for the Palestinians anymore. And they justified it by saying they were tired of the conflict. Those were the words the Emiratis used. And that's exactly what Kissinger had said, that you need time not only to build Israel's strength, but time to exhaust the Arabs so that eventually they would reach the point where they would accept Israel's existence and make peace or normalize relations with it.
I'm curious, you've interviewed him. I'm sure you hear things here and there and you can decide what you do or don't say on this podcast, but did you hear anything about what Kissinger thought of with the Abraham Accords? Any making comments of, haha, after all these decades, I've been vindicated or anything like that?
Yeah, it wasn't haha, but yeah.
Right, yeah, well, in the Kissinger way, I suppose.
He expressed satisfaction, yeah. But I tell you what he was much more satisfied with was an event that happened a little bit before that, which was that in that famous summit in Helsinki between Trump and Putin. Your listeners will not remember this part, I'm sure, but Putin referred to the Golan Heights disengagement agreement between Israel and Syria that Kissinger had negotiated back in 1974 as the basis for stabilizing the situation in Syria today. And it's an amazing fact that that disengagement agreement on the Golan Heights, which kept the peace on the Golan Heights more or less completely up until today, was not a peace agreement. It was just a disengagement agreement. Israel is still holding a large part of the Golan Heights. But the agreement separated the armies and created a basis for maintaining stability, which the Syrians have adhered to ever since 1974, even through the civil war. And while it's true that the Iranians are now pushing their militias up into that area of the Golan, Syrian government still seems to be kind of holding them back from attacking Israel and with the Russian support. So that's kind of vindication, as well as the Abraham Accords, of the way in which he used negotiations to produce agreements that stabilized the conflict rather than achieving full peace.
So in a retrospective, we began this discussion looking at the 30,000-foot view and what do we understand for diplomacy. So what can we learn from Kissinger's approach to diplomacy, whether Israel, Palestine, and I suppose what does it say about effective diplomacy when we look at Kissinger, when we look at Otto von Bismarck in this role of peace and order and the balance? So what does Kissinger say about this balance and what can we learn from him for both good and for ill?
Yeah. So I think that the first thing we can learn from him that he came to understand from his own experience that order alone, or let me put it differently, that a balance of power and an equilibrium in the balance of power was insufficient to preserve order. there needed, in the Arab-Israeli context, to be a peace process in which the Arabs felt that they could achieve redress for their grievances in order for the order to be stable. It had to be legitimate, and legitimacy came from a trade of territory for peace. And similarly, legitimacy can only be maintained in the order if there is a process of addressing Palestinian claims for fairness and justice. That's a lesson from Kissinger. It's perhaps a surprising one, but it's a one that he learned the hard way through his failure to take advantage of the Egyptian peace offer before the 73 war, and the way that resulted in war instead of order. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think, very important from my own experience, and I try to illuminate Kissinger's experience with my own to draw out these lessons in the book. But the second lesson is that peace needs to be approached in a gradual, incremental way, what he called step-by-step diplomacy. We, in particular at the end of the Clinton administration, but certainly other than American presidents, Secretary of State, pursued peace in the Middle East with too much passion, too much a sense of solutionism, and not enough caution and gradualism. And so today we need to, I think, go back to step-by-step effort in trying to resurrect the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But the third lesson is, that second lesson is, don't overreach. We learned that lesson now in Afghanistan as well, and in Iraq. But there's also another lesson from Kissinger's missteps, which is underreaching. Aiming too low also has its problems, as I explained, resulted in the 1973 war. But there's also an episode, a chapter in the book, in which I explain that Kissinger had a chance to work with Jordan and Israel to create an environment in which a Palestinian state could have emerged in a Jordanian context. And he didn't pursue that. He, in retrospect, refers to it as a big mistake, and I think it was. But it's the consequences of underreaching as well. So somehow we have to find a way, and this is the ultimate lesson from Kissinger, of finding a middle road between the solutionism and grand visions of comprehensive peace or rebuilding the nations of the Middle East as democracies, which is overreaching and which we've learned the hard way only leads to bad outcomes, whether it's intifadas or wars or collapses of the regimes that we've been supporting. But to underreach is problematic too, and we have to find a middle way in which we approach the Middle East in a gradual, incremental way as we try to change it. In this case, supporting countries in the region that take the lead because we no longer have the will to dominate the region. I think that's the right thing to do. But nevertheless, we need to find a way forward because we know that the region will not stand still. And it's kind of like the bicycle theory in the Middle East. If you're not pedaling forward, you're going to fall off. But we do not want to pedal forward too fast because that has all of its own problems as well.
Well, Kissinger is a great vehicle to explore these issues, the way that he's contemplated it, the way he's executed actions in different ways, and see his successes and his failures. And for listeners who want to explore this in the depth that you suggest in our conversation, your book is Master of the Game, Henry Kissinger and the Art of Middle East Diplomacy. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Scott.
All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.